This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The caterpillar chomped through one apple, two pears, three plums, four strawberries, five oranges, and one piece of chocolate cake. And in doing so, burrowed his way into the hearts and memories of millions of children across the world. Don't you remember the first time you read it or read it to a kid? That iconic caterpillar is the creation of Eric Carle, who passed away on Sunday at his home in Northampton. He was 91. We wanted to open the show today by remembering him in those wonderful books, and we're going to do that with Grace Lynn, award-winning children's book author, illustrator, and a board member of the Eric Carle Museum in Amherst. Grace, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
Grace, I'm sorry for your loss, for the family's loss. How are you today?
I feel really sad for the loss of the children's community. I mean, Eric Carle was just such a legend, and he, like, leaves a hole now that he's gone.
Grace, can you tell us, did he influence your work? Do you remember him from your own childhood? Has it shaped any of what you've done, the influences of those books?
Oh, very much so. I mean, who can't forget The Hungry Caterpillar? I mean, from those little small holes. I remember going through that book and, like, putting my finger in each of the holes and kind of, like, trying to see if I could fit, which fingers will fit in the holes that the caterpillar ate through the leaf. And I think being so fascinated with that book, even at a young age, and realizing what an impact it had on me. I mean, when I decided to become a children's book creator when I grew up, those are the books that I remember, the books that made such an impact, and that made me realize those were the books that I wanted to create.
And, of course, The Very Hungry Caterpillar has sold more than 55 million copies. It's been translated into more than 70 languages. I understand you brought a little excerpt from it that you're going to read for us.
Yes. So this is the end of the book, and it goes like this. The next day was Sunday again. The caterpillar ate through one nice green leaf, and after that, he felt much better. Now he wasn't hungry anymore, and he wasn't a little caterpillar anymore. He was a big, fat caterpillar. He built a small house called a cocoon around himself. He stayed inside for more than 2 weeks. Then he nibbled a hole in the cocoon, pushed his way out, and he was a beautiful butterfly.
Grace, I'm a little taken aback at how strong a response I'm having to hear you read that, right? From my own childhood. What is it about these books from our childhoods that stay with us in such a profound way?
Oh, I think it's because these are our first encounters with art. These are our first encounters with stories. This is our first encounter of how we want the world to be. And so as we grow older, we realize the world isn't the way they are in stories, but that's the way it should be. That's why when we hear them, we remember that kind of wistfulness, that desire, that in some ways, you know, I say innocence, but it's more than that. It's the earnestness of knowing how humanity should be.
You know, I read in one article today that he said it could take him 2 or 3 years to fully flesh out an idea for one of these books, that he'd, quote, start with 2,000 words and reduce them to 20. What do you know about his writing process? And how rare is it for somebody to know how to take 2,000 words of ideas and find just the right 20 to tell them?
Oh, I think that is something that many picture book creators go through. A lot of people say that writing a picture book is like writing a haiku, but you have to be able to tell a story through the haiku. So it's quite a challenging thing. I think there's this misconception that because it's for children and because there's so few words, that writing a picture book is easy. But it's quite difficult because every word counts so much. And to be a master like Eric Carle was, you have to pay attention to each word and make sure that each word is exactly what you mean, which is why it took him so long.
You talked about pictures there, too. Let's talk about that for a minute. I believe the first book he ever illustrated was Brown Bear, Brown Bear, What Do You See? In his biography, it seems to have shaped his work. We know he grew up in Germany and that the experiences of war influenced what he wanted to bring to his pages. Here he is speaking to NPR in 2007 about being in Germany in World War II.
Everything was gray and brown, with grays and greens and brown greens and gray greens and brown grays. You know, there was no color.
And there's so much color in these books. Talk about that. Is color healing? And is there a kind of intentionality to the pictures as well as the words when you want to bring kids along with these stories?
Yes, I think it's very important. I mean, it's the idea that you have so many colors, and the way that he illustrated, it makes it feel alive, you know, and that's what his stories and his books did for kids. They came alive for them because it became a part of their colorful, beautiful, vibrant world. And that's why I think he connected so much. And if their world wasn't vibrant and colorful, it made them want to be in the world that he created.
You know, we've already talked about the very hungry caterpillar. We've talked about a brown bear. There's also the mixed up chameleon, the grouchy ladybug, the very busy spider. What did Erik Carle see in insects or recognize in insects that made them such fantastic subjects for him?
Oh, well, that might be a little bit beyond me to tell you, but I imagine that he found a fascination with all these natural objects and how they could kind of relate to children. Because, you know, children, they see things so, they see the world so small. Like my daughter, like when it rains, she's not looking at the big rainstorm or the big clouds. She's looking at the teeny tiny worm that's coming out from the ground, you know, or when we're walking somewhere and we'll see something big and loud, like a huge truck, but she's looking at the teeny tiny pebbles on the ground. I imagine that Erik Carle knew this. He knew that kids were looking at the small things and they were wondering and looking at them with awe and marvel, these normal, ordinary things that adults walk by every day. And I think he probably realized that what wonder they held for kids and decided to show them or bring stories to that wonder for them.
Grace, you work with objects in your children's stories as well, kites, fortune cookies, and turn them into subjects that connect with kids. Should I now picture what you just said as the explanation of how you've found that magic in your own work?
Yes, I think so. And I think that's where Erik Carle really did affect me. I mean, I have a book called Dim Sum for Everyone. And it's, in some ways, it's just a very simple story of a family going to eat at dim sum. But it's the idea of taking something so ordinary and making it so magical and making it so momentous. Because in the book, the children pick their own food. And even though to adults that seems like no big deal, to a kid, that's a really big deal. It's like a moment of wonder, you know, it's a moment of empowerment. And I think that's one of the lessons that Erik Carle taught me.
Do you see any up-and-coming Erik Carles out there in the world of children's books today?
Oh, gosh, there's so many beautiful, beautiful picture books out there. In fact, I just curated an online picture book show for the Erik Carle Museum. As you mentioned, I'm a board member there. And
yes,
we curated a show called Asians Every Day in honor of Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month. And there are so many beautiful illustrators in that show. There's Jason Chin, who illustrated watercress. There is Dung Ho, who illustrated Eyes That Kiss Corners. There is Hu Won Lee, who illustrated Like a Dandelion. And this is just a couple just off the top of my head. So there are so many, many beautiful illustrators. And actually, that's one of the wonderful legacies that Erik Carle is leaving with us, is that he created this museum, the Erik Carle Museum of Picture Book Art, so that he could continue this love of picture book art, this kind of treasuring and fostering of children's book illustrations. I think he would agree that children's books, children's book art, they're kind of like one of humanity's cultural treasures. And that's why he started the museum.
Well, we'll put the museum website on our webpage. It's www.carlmuseum.org is the museum, and we are radioboston.org. Grace Lynn, award-winning children's book author, illustrator, and a board member of the Eric Carle Museum. Thanks for helping us remember Eric Carle today.
Thank you.
Memorial Day weekend, the unofficial start of summer, it's upon us, which means it is time to get your grill on. And even though the weather's going to feel probably more like early spring maybe than summer, this weekend marks the date that Massachusetts will lift all remaining COVID-19 restrictions, which means you might even celebrate in some of the ways we used to. So, with summer and reopening approaching, are you gonna grill? And what are you gonna make? What questions do you have about how to make it really good? That's what we're doing, and we want you to call. You can also share some of your favorite grilling sauces, marinades, items to put on the grill, creations. Let's have some fun with this, folks. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So we have two guests we're welcoming back to grill and talk grill with us, local chef and culinary instructor Joe Gatto, host of From Scratch on Pluto TV, and Cheryl Strotter, chef and owner of Soleil in Nubian Square. Cheryl, welcome back.
Thank you. It's a joy to be here. I'm excited.
I am too. And Chef Joe, great to have you back too.
I am excited.
All right, let's do this. Cheryl, why? Why are we so excited? What is it about the grill that just makes us all so happy?
There is something that is really cool when you put fire to food and you get that charcoal or smoky taste that's infused in whatever is on your grill.
All right. So that gives me a chance to say, okay, Joe, you are the From Scratch guy. You have actually made charcoal on your show. So picking up on what Cheryl just said, what is the key to a good charcoal for getting that smokiness and the right flavor into whatever's on the grill?
I mean, the big thing for me when I'm on the grill is you want to get those coals super hot. You want to make sure they're white and really, really hot, where you can't really hold your hand too long over those coals because, you know, you're really looking for that heat for caramelization, which is the key to everything, so we can get that beautiful sear. If we're cooking too early, we don't want that to happen because we're not going to get that browning happening and that caramelization and that yumminess. So definitely get your grill hot. That's a big, big thing.
And Cheryl, are you an agnostic on the ancient battle of gas versus charcoal, or do you have a preference?
I actually have both at my house. It depends on the flavor that I want in the protein that I'm cooking, or actually the vegetable that I'm cooking. So I enjoy using both methods. And as was shared, it must be hot, whether it's the charcoal or the gas. I'm a big fan of marinating items, but I do like both.
All right, so we're going to get to the veggies thing and the marinating thing in just a minute. But listeners, 1-800-423-8255. Are you going to grill this weekend? Are you charcoal or gas? If you're about to go to a barbecue and you haven't since before the pandemic, what are you most looking forward to? And let's hear about those vegetables and sauces. Unusual things that you can cook on a grill. We want to hear about all of it from you. All right, so let's talk about veggies that grill well. Joe.
I'm a big bok choy fan. I just think that's such
I was
a
not expecting the first vegetable to be bok choy. Sorry, you threw me.
Out of the gate, you know, I like to throw a little curveball. So, you know, I just love how that grills up with those beautiful grill marks and you're getting that nice browning. It's just a delicious vegetable to throw on there and it always surprises people. So, you know, that I think that's a great one to start with.
And what else?
Oh, I mean, corn. You know, you got to go corn.
And how? How do you do corn without burning it? How do you do it without burning it?
You know, you want to get a little char on that corn. So what I do to cut down time when, you know, we're cooking for the family or having a big epic barbecue doing something like that, you know, I boil it beforehand just to cook it, and then I finish it on the grill, and you want that char on there, you know? You want to get that beautiful char to get those flavors so it's getting nice and complex because the sugars in the corn are going to just slightly char and burn and brown, and it's going to be all different flavors and textures through the whole corn, you know, and the whole cob. So yeah, corn's a big, huge one. And then you can make a nice little, you know, garlic butter or something that, like that for the table, which people will slather all over it and shove in their pie hole.
Yeah, that sounds good. So I'm assuming then, unshucked, no foil, nothing, straight on the grill.
Yeah, I go straight on the grill. I'm a big believer in that.
Straight on, that's right. Cheryl, how about you and vegetables? We have a lot of vegetarians out there who want to be able to enjoy the grilling, and there's so much great stuff you can put on a grill.
There is. If you cut the vegetables lengthwise, let's say, for example, zucchini or yellow squash, that grills nicely. You could always do the circular cut for eggplant, but I also like sweet potatoes on a grill as well. Mm. So anything veggie and firm works for me on a grill.
So with sweet potatoes, I'm curious about this. Do you, you know, bake them first and finish them on a grill, kind of the way Joe said he boils the corn and then finishes it on the grill? Or do you do that potato on the grill from beginning to end?
I started out with some water to get it a little tender. Really, you don't want it too soft. You want it a little firm so it will stand up on the grill. But I do put it in the water, some seasoning, and then put it on the grill with some cinnamon and brown sugar. Amazing. Mm.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. Yeah. I'm going to throw that number out one more time to listeners, 1-800-423-8255. So I want to get to marinades, but first I feel like the elephant in the room is the fact that it may be warm today, but it's not going to be great weather this weekend. But people still grill, right? You can still grill in the cold. Joe, do you grill in the cold? Are you going to grill no matter what the weather is this weekend?
If it was snowing, I'd be grilling. I mean, let's be honest. I'll have a snowman grill mate next to me, and I love grilling all the time. Whether, you know, whatever it is, I'm out there. I like getting the fire started. I like being out back. I just love the whole grilling experience.
And do you grill something different when it's chillier than if it's, you know, 90 degrees out?
You know, it's really just like whatever I have, I'm grilling. So it could be salmon, you know, it could be filet, it could just be, you know, we do tamales at the house a lot, and those finish beautifully on the grill because you can get a little smoke on them. So anything I can throw on fire, I'm throwing on fire.
So, Cheryl, I think a lot of people probably won't let the bad weather this weekend keep them from being together. And it still sticks with me. We had you on the show recently to talk about Soleil and the vibe that you have missed. And that's really stuck with me. So what is the vibe of the barbecue? And what are you most looking forward to getting back to with that?
I think the vibe around barbecue is everybody getting together. We have been so separated for the past year. And the vibe with food, it's a common thread that we all have. We all eat whatever our culture is. So I miss the excitement and the joy and the stories and the fun and the laughter. That's the vibe that I look for when I'm grilling.
Let's go to the phones here. 1-800-423-8255. We've got Dave on the line in Orleans. Tell us about grilling, Dave. What do you want to talk about?
Hi. I just wanted to mention the portabellas.
For grilling. How do you cook them, Dave?
Well, my girlfriend likes to get them with the soy sauce. So you just fill them up like a little bowl with some soy sauce, a little fish sauce, and then, you know, a little S&P. Put them right on the grill, and it just steams up. I was like, okay, you know, I'm not a portobello guy, but I was blown away.
That does sound delicious. Joe Gatto, is that the prime way to cook portobellos on the grill?
Yeah, I was wondering what time he was going to invite me over. You know, that sounds delicious.
Yeah, we're doing them tonight.
Okay,
say that again, Dave. You're doing them tonight
for you.
we grill every night. You got to grill early and often.
There you go.
Oh,
and yes,
guy.
You grill all winter long. Get that grill going, in my opinion.
Amen to that.
Absolutely.
So, okay, but to that point, what about our listeners, Cheryl, who don't have a grill, can't grill outside? How do you get some of that grill feel cooking indoors? You know, you use a skillet, do you fire up the George Foreman? You know, how do you do that?
So there are some pans that are perforated and you get those ridges that will give that grill look. So let's say, for example, I want to have some salmon. A neat way to do salmon is to marinate it. And a marinade, a real quick one, is an acid, an oil, and an herb. So for example, you could mix lemon, lemon juice, lemon rind with an oil and some fresh herbs. Let your salmon sit in that for a little while and put it on a hot perforated pan and it will look like it was grilled.
That sounds fantastic, but I did notice that you said look. You did not say taste. Well,
it will taste, it will still taste, you know, as if it were cooked inside. It will look and give the appearance of being grilled. You can make a smoker in your house. You know, I don't know how much people want to get into foil and wood chips and things like that in their home, but you can actually make a small version of a smoker on your stove.
Awesome. All right, listeners, acid plus oil plus spice. What ones do you like to combine? Call us with your favorite marinades, sauces for grilling, 1-800-423-8255. Joe Gatto, Marquise in our studio wants to know about a good mix for some spicy wings. What do you got?
I mean, spicy wings, I'm a big believer in like a dry rub and then hitting it with the sauce after. And for that, you know, I'm using some cayenne, I'm using some chipotle so I can get a little smoke and heat, some chili powder, cumin, garlic powder, onion powder, and then I'm rubbing those wings down, then I'm baking those off, and then I'm finishing them on the grill when I'm hitting them with a nice barbecue sauce that I've made, because you want to let those wings cook first and then hit them with the sauce at the very end so you're not burning your sauce, but you're getting that nice char on there. And it's all sticking and makes that gooey mess that you can just, you know, you should be using at least 10 napkins.
So Cheryl, you talked about proteins earlier and you've given us sort of the formula for a marinade, but what about rubs? What rubs do you love to use with what proteins? Can you put a rub on anything you grill?
So I'm pretty consistent with the rub and the ingredients that were shared is what I use across the board. I mean, it's important to have that cayenne, that cumin. Those are good combinations. I like onion powder. There are pre-made rubs that you can get in the store if you don't want to follow a recipe. But it is important to rub and then cook because you want to season your food at each level. I know some people will just take chicken, they'll put it in a marinade, and then put it on the grill. I season my chicken, let it sit for a few hours, then I'll put it in a marinade. Like, I want that intense flavor at every level that I am handling the food.
So what about ambiance, the two of you? When you host, what is important other than what's on the grill? Joe?
I mean, you have to have music and tons of people. I mean, for me, like, if there's some great tunes going and there's a ton of family and friends there and the fire is going and I'm grilling, I'm set. Okay, maybe a drink in my hand. So, you know, that to me is that screams summer, that screams fun. I'm actually planning a big barbecue at my house coming up at the end of July, which we're calling the epic post-pandemic barbecue of 2021. And we're shutting down the whole street. Because, like, that's the kind of party I want. And I want that grill going, you know, I want to go through 2 or 3 propane tanks during the day.
Wow. And how about for you, Cheryl? What goes alongside what's on the grill to make a great barbecue?
So you would think that he and I were sitting together because he stole my thunder. You've got to have good music. You have to have people inside and outside. I love entertaining on my deck, on my grass, in my house. You know, some sort of cocktail has got to go along with it, you know, that complements the food. And just people getting together. That's, I mean, he and I, wait a minute, when's the party?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm going to have to get your email and throw an invite out there.
Well, you know, you guys are breaking my heart. We for 18 years in a row held a Memorial Weekend barbecue. And of course, last year didn't do it, couldn't do it. This year didn't plan it because we thought we couldn't do it. And you're making me hunger for those times back together, right? It fills us up. It fills our cups so much. So producer Jamie Bologna wants to know about grilling pizza. If you want to try to grill pizza, what do you have to keep in mind? What are the conditions for grilled pizza success?
I mean, we grill pizzas a lot for big events we do in the seaport. We're always using the grill for that. You can do it directly on the grates if you pre-bake your crust a bit. But, you know, for us, we use a product called the steel, the baking steel, which goes right on our grill. And we can get that up to, you know, 500, 600 degrees and really get that super hot. Because for me, that's the key to a good pizza is when you're sliding on your pizza dough, you want that leoparding on the bottom. You want that beautiful leopard crust on the bottom. And you don't want it to cook too long. You just want it to rise and you want the cheese to melt on top. So we're really looking for a lot of heat. I love using the steel. You can use a stone as well. I find the steel is much more effective than a stone because the stones crack very easily. If you're doing it directly on the grates, though, I mean, that's something, you know, you want to do it 3/4 of the way in your oven. That way you can do it, you know, just dough onto the grates, but you could have a couple miscues that way. But if you want to make it really easy, do it partly in your oven, then finish your whole pizza on the grill and, you know, get some lump charcoal on there so you get the smoke, you get the fire, and you'll get that beautiful effect on it. It will be delicious.
All right, so Cheryl, Joe gave us a lot of good coaching there about what goes underneath the pizza. If you're going to grill a pizza, what's the best thing to put on top of it?
I'm a big fan of veggies and chicken some sort of way. So it could be little pieces of barbecue chicken or jerk chicken. But I like that as a protein. You could do other things, but that's my favorite, my go-to.
All right. So as we were preparing for this segment, producer Paris Alston threw down the challenge, which was to ask you guys how to make, pick one, an Impossible Burger, a Beyond, a Veggie, a Turkey Burger taste as good as an all-beef one on the grill. So I have thrown down. Who's going to accept the challenge?
To make a turkey burger as good as a beef burger? Is that the challenge?
Can you do it?
I've got a really good little tip. So
go for it.
My wife doesn't eat beef. And what I do is I take the turkey meat and then I have like an Italian turkey sausage and I grind that up and mix it in with the turkey meat. And you get this amazing flavor, and it holds together, and like people just can't figure out why it's so tasty. So it's a good way instead of just adding spices.
Okay, but that's kind of because you're putting pork in there.
No. It's a turkey sausage.
Oh, okay. I'm like, Joe, I think you're stepping out of the bounds of the challenge.
So, yeah, here we go. So we're going to throw some beef and pork into the turkey burger. No. No, we're going to throw a turkey sausage and grind that up in the food processor. It's a good little just tip and really easy, and you can change the flavors up really, really, really simply.
All right, so actually that sounds fabulous. Cheryl, how about you? Impossible, you know, a veggie burger of some kind. Can you make that as satisfying at least as a beef burger on a grill?
Impossible burger is a good replication of a beef burger. The thing with Impossible Burgers is you have to infuse it with a lot of seasoning. So I like Montreal steak seasoning rubbed into the Impossible Burger. That's the best that I've tasted so far when it comes to a non-traditional burger using the steak, Montreal steak seasoning.
Now, I have to say, for the prime burger in our house is ground sirloin with a rub of Lawry's seasoned salt and Montreal steak spice, and then, you know, cooking that. So also, let's just talk about, we just got a little bit of time, Joe, quality of the protein. How important is that?
That's everything.
Can you make
it?
Okay.
That's everything. I mean, quality is what counts. I mean, the best way for me cooking is very few ingredients, but quality ingredients. And, you know, for me, I'm not a big on, like, big, huge burgers. I like sliders. That's my jam. But doing a grind yourself, you know, we use a little brisket, chuck, you know, and grinding that and getting just top-notch beef, you want to taste the beef. And that's what the whole burger is about. So spend your money there, you know, and make some rolls yourself. They're super easy to make, and that's a really tasty treat.
All right, Joe Gatto, host of From Scratch on Pluto TV, and Cheryl Strotter, chef and owner of Soleil in Nubian Square. That was fun. Thanks, both of you, and happy barbecuing this weekend.
Thank you, Tiziana. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Everybody, get grilling.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Paula Cole and her smash 90s hit, Where Have All the Cowboys Gone? Maybe you're a big Paula Cole fan, or maybe you just know her from this song or the Dawson's Creek theme. But what you might not know is Cole was the first woman nominated for a Grammy without collaborators as Producer of the Year in 1997. She has been nominated 7 times and won for Best New Artist. Cole grew up in Rockport, Massachusetts, with musicians as parents who instilled a love of music, all music.
Well, I thought it was perfectly normal to grow up in a family where everyone played multiple instruments and we all sang in 4-part harmony. That was my reality. But what I learned, and my father, was that music was self-made and music was joyful and fun. And there was just always music being made live in the home.
Where is my job?
She went to Berkeley, backup sang with Peter Gabriel, and eventually turned her focus to writing her own music, stepping away for a bit after her major double platinum success and getting back to her roots. Cole is out now with her 11th album, American Quilt, a tapestry of jazz, folk, country covers of some of her musical inspirations.
For me, they are people like Bessie Smith and Nina Simone and Billie Holiday and Miles Davis, so many beautiful people, Dolly Parton, Emmylou Harris. And I want to share those beautiful masters who helped form me. I started as a jazz singer. I was my first gig ever. I was a teenager and I was at Ryle's in Cambridge singing with a big band. And I worked through college singing jazz and I wanted to be a vocal improviser, but so often I was singing the lyrics of, let's just say, white men, you know, from mostly from musicals and the early part of American music and mid-century American music. And those stories weren't so fitting to my truth. So that's when I had this pivotal aha moment that I started writing my truths. And that's what caused me to start writing my own music. But there was still this latent dream inside of me to sing jazz, and I love listening to this music. And that's when I realized I need to show all of who I am. I need to show the side of me that was influenced by Emmylou Harris and Johnny Cash and some of the roots musicians from other genres. You know, that we create these divisions, these genres. I hate it personally because it's usually based on race and age and gender, but it's American music.
This album, American Quilt, does cross genders. It crosses race. It crosses decades. And it really does bring forward so many of the people that you've named that inspire you. Let's listen a little bit to your take on Bessie Smith's Black Mountain Blues.
Back in Black Mountain, a child will smack your face.
So, Paula, I mean, it's in my gut, right? You feel that in your very core. Tell us about this track, your take on it, why you included it.
Well, I love Bessie Smith. I love Bessie Smith, and Billie Holiday loved Bessie Smith, and Janis Joplin loved Bessie Smith. So much of modern music is flowing from Bessie Smith. Imagine the extraordinarily difficult life she lived. Imagine being a bisexual woman of color in the Prohibition era, always taking the back door. So I feel her pain. I feel her lessons. I hear her cautionary advice. And I just wanted to honor her because out of Bessie comes modern music.
So let's fast forward a little bit now. You've got Blackbird on the album, which really spoke to me. You know, Miles Davis did a classic version of it. He's kind of 1950s pioneering jazz. Let's listen to a little bit of it.
Pack up all my cares and woe. Here I go, singing low. Bye-bye, Blackbird. Where somebody waits for me, sugar sweet, and so is he. Bye bye, Blackbird.
I wanted to give myself a platform to finally vocally improvise because I've been this closet scat singer, you know, an vocal improviser for a long time, and I improvise in my own music a lot, but not necessarily over jazz, and I wanted to finally show that part of myself.
So these are two Black artists, Bessie Smith, Miles Davis. You also channel Coltrane on the album. Talk a little bit about being a white woman doing honor to these artists and songs.
Oh, I know. Here I am, a white woman, and yet part of my purpose is to talk about race. For me, I would say there's all these divisions and genre lines, and I don't like them because therefore it means I can't exist. But here I am existing, and here I am influenced by this beautiful music, and it's part of my purpose to talk about it. My family, my daughter and my niece are biracial. It's part of me.
We are in a moment where often artists, authors, actors can not be thoughtful as they portray characters or can be criticized for cultural appropriation. What is the difference between honoring people of another race or culture who came before you and appropriating art? Do you think about that, and how do you think about walking that line?
Oh, it's a very important line, and I think about it so much. And I don't want ever to be on the wrong side of history or hurt anybody. I think it's important to, if that is your influence, to acknowledge it and acknowledge it lovingly. It's always my intention to talk about it so we can heal. This country is so fraught. Its history is so sad and so violent. And we wouldn't even be here without, you know, African people being robbed from their homes and taken here to create the great American economy that was based on cotton and sugar and rice and so on and so forth. We wouldn't even be here as a world nation without that. And we forget it every day, and we can't forget it. We have to remember it every day.
Let's pick up on that, Paula, because American quilt, there are two meanings to that. One, your mother quilted. There's a deep personal connection there. But you also took inspiration from Black American history, the Underground Railroad, and quilts that were used to help enslaved peoples escape.
Yes. So I'm a patchwork. I'm a patchwork genetically. My family is all genetic mixture and from different heritages and cultures. And I realized this music is such a mixture, and I realized the quilt is the perfect metaphor, and it also honors my mom being a quilter and having Native American blood in her. And the quilt, so I that concept, I started thinking on quilting more and learned so much about slave quilts. And I know it's not my story to tell, but the story is not talked about very often. And I wanted to reflect that voice in the track listing, in the sequence of American Quilt. Again, it was not represented, and I felt it should be because it's so vital.
Tell our listeners what a slave quilt is.
I learned about it from the voice of a woman, Ozella, that was interviewed by two writers, and they wrote a book named Hidden in Plain View about slave quilts, and I learned a lot about it. Women, because it was women's work, right, sewing, slave women would create these quilts, and within each patchwork, each patch was a theme, a design that gave clues and advice to the slaves on the plantations to escape successfully to the Underground Railroad. And let me give you an example. So there's a patch called Flying Geese. And in spring, if you're down in the south, you look to the sky and you look for the flying geese, and they're flying north in the spring. So you follow the geese. They will take you north because you wanted to go to Canada where you would be free over the border. Flying geese, it's still a quilting pattern. Also, Bear Trail, for example. Bear Trail is a quilting pattern. It still exists. Bear Trail means follow the tracks of animals, because animal tracks will take you to water. Animal tracks will take you to places to hide and be safe. There's a patch called Drunkard's Path. You do not walk a straight line when you are trying to flee bloodhounds and men with guns. Each square represents, and it's absolutely ingenious and fascinating. And when I was learning this, I mean, I'm getting chills up my arms just thinking about it. I was so overcome. And I would mention it to people, and they would not know. They would not know about slave quilts. So that's when I realized, how do I share this? I should put it into a song. So I wrote a song, and each verse is a quilting square. And it takes you through the journey to Canada, to your freedom.
This is Hidden in Plain Sight.
Keep under lightning, brightening your way. Keeping the wicked ones' hounds at bay. Don't walk a straight line, it'll give you away. Double back and walk a drunkard's path. Keep safe. Double back and walk a drunkard's path. Keep safe.
I was very reluctant to put it on because I thought this was going to be an album full of covers. And my drummer, Jay Bellarose, to whom I dedicate the album, he insisted I put the song on, and it was a little uncomfortable for me. I guess I was scared a little bit about, you know, me telling this story, being a white person, but the story just wasn't out there in a song, and I wanted it to be out there as a song so that we could talk about it. And you know what? It was women's work. It was women's work. And that's another reason why I wanted to talk about it, because women's work is dismissed. And what a wonderful place to hide a revolutionary movement is in those that are overlooked, dismissed. The oppressed will always have to be ingenious.
You seem also to be trying now to be a champion for artists to be able to make a living, right? To be able to earn from their music, to own their music in all the different senses. I'm thinking of, you know, I Don't Want to Wait on Dawson's Creek in the 1990s. When the show came to Netflix at the end of last year, your song wasn't used in the opening credits. Your fans were upset. Sony is restoring your song to the online streaming version of the show. There were royalties in that picture. Explain that a little bit and tell us what you've learned about your role in standing up for artists.
I decided to just be very patient about it. And I never wanted to be in any kind of argument or confrontational situation with the other artist whose song was used at that time. That was just some corporate executive wanting to save money who made a precipitous decision. So, to be clear,
they replaced your song with someone else's song.
That's right. And it just happened overnight. I didn't know. Nobody asked me. But the fans, yeah, my phone would light up every time, like it would reappear on a new series or a new season on a new platform. And they complained. They were not happy about it. And that was interesting to me to see how important the song was to them with the TV show. Finally, they listened. But meanwhile, I had re-recorded the track because I was so screwed in that record deal. I wasn't going to use that song for anything else. I wasn't going to let anybody use that original recording. No. I was going to re-record that, which I did in 2015. And if they wanted to use it, then they would need to use my re-recorded master, which is now in play, and it's been utilized a few times with sync licenses, and now Sony is using it again with Dawson's Creek. So soon we'll hear that. That was a vindication, not just for me, but for all artists. We shouldn't give our music away for free, not to network television or, you know, giant corporations. They have so much money, and the artists have so little money. It's colossally unfair. I wasn't going to do that.
You work at Berklee, and you teach in performance. We are, all consumed right now about how we are going to reemerge from this pandemic. And, of course, live music was one of the many things that were, casualties of this pandemic. What is that pause? What has it done to how we think about live music performance? What do you think it'll mean for the industry going forward?
Yes, I feel so lucky to be associated with Berklee College of Music. It's my alma mater. And I was fortunate to be professor for 7 years. Now I'm a visiting scholar, so I can tour more easily. And my touring was completely shelved in 2020, like all the other artists. And once again, I was fortunate for my hit songs because they allowed me to stay alive and keep my family alive. And I continued making music. I'm very self-employed and self-driven. And so I'm writing a book, and I was working on a new album through the pandemic. Thank God we were safe. I had old folks to look after in Rockport. I had young folks to look after. I was sandwiched in the middle, but I was working and inspired. And in not being on the road was a gift. I had time for my family and my projects in a way I had not had in a while. So I embraced that silence. I embraced that time. You know, hopefully we'll all come back. I've got a whole bunch of touring in the fall in 21. We'll see, though, right? I mean, we'll see. Will people want to come out? I think yes. If we're vaccinated, then they will come out. We can be 6 feet apart or maybe even shoulder to shoulder. We'll see. But get vaccinated and, you know, participate in this joyful human experience again. My goodness.
Grammy-winning singer, songwriter, and producer Paula Cole, a Rockport native. She's also a visiting scholar in performance studies at Berklee College of Music. Her 11th album, American Quilt, is now out. And since we talked about it in the interview, we thought it was only appropriate that we go out today on her classic hit, I Don't Want to Wait. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. She thought it was gone.